Good evening.
Good evening.
Oh, so nice to see everybody. Back in Kirkwood, Missouri, where I grew up, people would greet each other saying, "Hot enough for you?" Oh, yeah. So, an old friend has returned. Like a swallow. Every year.
Well, I say it's Capistrano, but it's Floating Zendo.
Floating Zendo is much, much better than Capistrano. We're so glad to see you.
It's good to be back. Even for a short time.
Yeah, I can imagine. Dan lives and works in China. So, yeah. Teaches college now?
English
in college. That's great. Wonderful to see you. Let's do introductions around. There are probably faces you don't recognize.
Carolyn.
Judy.
I'm there. Mm-hmm.
Wendy.
Judy.
Marie.
Paul.
Jennifer.
Nico.
Karin.
Ellie.
Angie. So you've been here before, Judy?
Charlene.
Well, that's what I thought. I thought you said Judy, and I thought, no.
That's
somebody else.
I definitely said Charlene, but maybe I said it too quietly.
I thought it was you, and I was going to ask you how your father is doing. So I'm glad to see you. We have a famous chapter in this. This is when people think of Vimalakirti, they often think of this chapter, which in Cleary's translation is called The Goddess. And in this translation, it's more modest. It's just called Regarding Living Beings, which is really the crux of it. It's kind of the bottom line of how to look at other people, and which that's our big essential question and problem and challenge is, how do we see others? We kind of think we know what this is, at least we have a sense of this or me or mine, but then who are all these others? And they're all walking and talking and doing funny things just like I am. And it's very mysterious. And what am I supposed to do with them? So here's Vimalakirti lying in bed. You have to remember, he's always responding, lying in bed at his ease. And now Manjushri begins to ask him questions. And Manjushri, of course, is sitting on a very high chair now. So I sometimes think that somebody like David Hockney should illustrate this, because the picture, if you think of it, is so funny. And he could do a wonderful job with it. He's done children's books that are just wonderful. So we have to imagine it. That this bodhisattva is way up in a high chair, and Vimalakirti is all laid back and at his ease in bed. And Vimalakirti says, "How does the bodhisattva regard living beings? How do we look at other people?" It's a very important, very, very important question. It's really the only one. Vimalakirti says, as an intelligent person looks on the beings he conjures up. He says a conjurer here, but Cleary calls him an intelligent person. Conjures it up. The bodhisattva looks at people like that. As the wise view the moon and the water, or a face or a form seen in a mirror, as shimmers of heat in a torrid season, as the echo that follows a cry, as clouds in the sky, as foam on the water, bubbles on the water, as a thing no firmer than the trunk of the plantain, no longer lasting than a flash of lightning, as a fifth great element, a sixth component, a seventh sense media, a 13th sense media, a 19th sense realm. Thus does Bodhisattva regard living beings. As forms in the world of formlessness, as sprouts from charred grain, as mistaken views of the body in one who has entered the stream that leads to the state of arhat, as a re-emerging of the womb by one no longer subject to rebirth, as the three poisons of greed, hate, and ignorance, as greed, hate, anger, or violation of the precepts on the part of a bodhisattva, as vestiges of earthly desire in a Buddha, as forms seen by a blind person, as breathing in and out of one immersed in the samadhi of utter tranquility, as the tracks of a bird in the sky, as a child born to a barren woman, as earthly desires in a phantom being, as sights in a dream after one has wakened, as the taking on of bodily form by one who has entered extinction, as fire that has no smoke. Thus does the Bodhisattva regard living beings. So Manjushri says, if the Bodhisattva looks on beings in this way, how can he treat them with compassion? Or as Cleary says, with kindness. If he looks at them as bubbles in a stream or bird tracks in the sky, how do you treat people like that? And Vimalakirti replied, when the Bodhisattva has finished regarding them in this way, he thinks to himself, for the sake of living beings, I must preach the law to them. This is true compassion. He says, this kindness toward all beings comes about as a true refuge. He treats them with a compassion of tranquil extinction. And then he goes on to a long list of all the ways that he treats them, and I will tell you what those are, but he goes into detail about what that means. So you'll have to look it up. Compassion that's impartial, free of contention, undualistic, unfaltering, not divided, firm and durable. For the mind of the Bodhisattva never flags. Compassion clean and pure, as the nature of all phenomena is pure. Treats them with a compassion boundless, boundless as the empty sky. He treats them with a compassion of an arhat, of the Bodhisattva, of the Buddha, with a compassion wholly natural, understanding that it is causeless. That's an important point. That if we gin up some kind of kindness and compassion and think it's my idea, my intention, and my will, that's a real different kind of kindness and compassion from the one that's natural. And really you can say that our practice is about connecting with the natural and being that. So we call it authenticity or honesty. Not trying to put on some extra thing onto it, but just naturally being our best self, you could say. and understanding that it's causeless. It's just, it's not coming from anywhere. It's, you can't put your finger on it. It's just already. It's one of the already-nesses of our life itself. You don't have to look out there for it. It is already. It's a compassion that has no gradation. It treats people with great pity and compassion, guiding them with the great vehicle. He treats them with a compassion that never despairs, seeing that all is empty and without ego. Treats them with a compassion of bestowal of the law, observance of the precepts, compassion of forbearance, of assiduousness, of not relishing meditation, but with compassion of meditation, and with wisdom, and expedient means, with manifestations in every occasion, figuring out each time what this occasion requires. So it's just like life itself. There isn't any, it's not written down how we should do it moment by moment. We are a responding little animal, and this is about how we respond, with what kind of mind we bring to each encounter. He treats them with a compassion that hides nothing, proceeding with the purity of an upright mind. That's hard sometimes if we're really upset or mad about something that's happening and somebody says, oh, how are you? Oh, fine. Fine. Everything's fine. So it doesn't mean that we lay our problems on people, but it is to be straightforward and at least allow ourselves to be seen, to be seen clearly. We're each of us very beautiful to see, the inside as well as the outside. And it's a treat for people to be able to see in this way. So often we're just masks. Compassion full of peace and delight. For through it they gain the delight of the Buddha. And delight's a big part of it too. It's such a serious and hard kind of practice in a lot of ways. Our knees hurt and we have to sit for a long, long time, and if it's hot, we're really hot. And it's a challenge physically. It's a big challenge. And yet, it's a delight. There is within us a joyousness. So that's what he says, actually. Manjushri said, what do you mean when you speak of pity? What is the basis of great compassion? And Vimalakirti says, I mean that whatever benefits the bodhisattva gains, he gives them all to all other living beings. And that's the basis of Buddha's practice. Gives them all to other living beings. Manjushri said, well, what do you mean by joy? And Vimalakirti says, any way a bodhisattva can aid or enrich others, he views as an occasion for joy. Manjushri says, now we have another list of questions. What do you mean, questions? What do you mean by indifference, impartiality, Vimalakirti says, whatever blessings or good fortune the Bodhisattva bestows, he expects nothing in return. The question, if the Bodhisattva is afraid the cycle of birth and death, what should he rely on? That's a crucial question. Every human being, because we're able to think that there was a beginning and an end to us, have to ask this question. What do we rely on if we're going to die? Vimalakirti said, the Bodhisattva, fearing the cycle of birth and death, should rely on the power of the Tathagata's blessing. And Manjushri says, if he hopes to rely on that, what course should he pursue? Says, if he hopes to rely on that power, he should devote himself to saving and liberating all living beings. Manjushri says, if he hopes to do that, what must he do to free them? Vimalakirti says, if he hopes to do that, he must free them from earthly desires or afflictions, according to Cleary, which is the old-fashioned real Buddha word. We're afflicted by our desires. Manjushri says, if we're doing that, how to do that? How should we proceed? Vimalakirti says, wisely. He says, how to be wise? How am I supposed to do that? Vimalakirti says, you proceed on the premise of no birth and no extinction. Don't worry about the beginning and the end. There is non-production, non-destruction. Then, of course, he has to ask, what is that? And Vimalakirti says, non-production of evil and non-destruction of good. This is a very crucial question that every human being comes to if they start to think about things. Why is there evil in the world? And what do we do about it? And if we're very insightful and actually begin to study ourselves, we begin to discover it in us as well as out there. What do we do with it? How do we understand it? In some religions, God is supposed to be ever-loving and ever-helpful, and it's hard for kids to figure out why God can make bad things happen as well as good things happen. So what he's saying here is about how we ourselves produce or don't produce evil, and we ourselves produce or don't produce good. And this was Buddha's first teaching. He said, we see our mind, and so we see how it is with us, and we don't have to go to the part that we know is not wholesome and helpful and good, and cultivate the part that is good. So there's no magical kind of wonderful transformation and everything gets to be good, including us. It's a matter of really working with ourselves all the time and recognizing in the world as well how difficult it is, especially for some people, how hard it is to do this little extra operation that it takes to recognize and put a stop to what isn't such a good idea or such a wholesome good thought. But of course Manjushri isn't finished. You'd think he knew everything. He's the wisdom guy, but in this case he doesn't. So he wants to know, what is the root of good and not good? Vimalakirti says, the body is the root. the idea of an enduring body. In Manjushri, what's the root of the body? Bimalakirti, desire and greed are the root. What's the root of desire and greed? False and empty distinctions are the root. Or, in Cleary's, it is construction of what doesn't exist. It's just thinking. We believe our thoughts and believe they're real. What is the root of false and empty distinctions? Topsy-turvy thinking. It's so funny. Topsy-turvy thinking. What's the root of that? Groundless assumptions are the root of topsy-turvy thinking. It's so simple. We think we know when we don't. Manjushri wants to know, of course, what the root of that is, and Bimalakirti says the groundless can have no root. Manjushri, it is on the root of this groundlessness that all the other concepts are built up. All things are established on the basis of truth having no foundation. So at that time, there was a heavenly being, a goddess, in Vimalakirti's room. Just where'd she come from? Who, seeing these great men and hearing them expound the law, proposed to make herself visible and scattered heavenly flowers all over the bodhisattvas and disciples. And the flowers all fell off the bodhisattvas. They just floated down and off is their robes, and everything was beautiful, but they stuck all over the disciples. And Shariputra doesn't like that. He's really offended by flowers being stuck on him. I think maybe that he thinks they're kind of girly or something. And he says, these flowers are inappropriate. He says, that's why I'm trying to brush them off. And the goddess said, don't say these flowers are not in accordance with the law, because flowers makes no such distinctions. You and your thinking have made up these distinctions, that's all. If you've left household life to follow the Buddha's law, you don't make distinctions anymore. That's not in accordance with the law. The flowers don't stick to the bodhisattvas because they've already cut off all thoughts of distinctions. So you disciples are scared of the cycle of birth and death and of form and sound and smell and taste and touch take advantage of you. So Shariputra said, goddess, he's kind of curious now. Have you been staying in this room long? She says, venerable sir, nay, my stay in this room is about as long as your attainment of emancipation. Shariputra says, so, you've been here a long time. And Bimalakirti says, the goddess says, venerable sir, how long has your attainment of emancipation been? And he's silent. He doesn't answer. She says, with your great wisdom, venerable sir, why do you remain silent? Shariputra replies, emancipation cannot be spoken of. Therefore, I do not know what I can say to you. The goddess said, words, writing, they're all marks of emancipation. Emancipation is not internal or external and not in between. Words likewise are not internal, external, are not in between. So, Shariputra, you can speak of emancipation without putting words aside, because all things that exist are marks of emancipation. You can't start cutting off one thing and another and try to be all perfect and pure and separate. Shariputra says, doesn't emancipation mean putting aside lewdness, anger, and stupidity? The goddess said, the Buddha, addressing persons of overbearing arrogance, asserted that one must put aside lewdness, anger, and stupidity in order to gain emancipation. That's all. If he was addressing those who were free of overbearing arrogance, the Buddha asserted that the nature of lewdness, anger, and stupidity is emancipation itself. You get the difference? Shariputra said, excellent. Goddess, what have you attained? What have you seen into that you speak with such eloquence? And she replied, I have attained nothing. Seen into nothing, and hence speak with eloquence. If one claims to have seized on something or seen into something, then in the light of Buddha's law, one is being overbearingly arrogant. He says, of the three vehicles, which do you pursue? So now we get some questions from Shariputra to the goddess. She said, I use the law of the disciples to convert living beings. And therefore, I practice the way of the voice hearer. I use the law of causes and conditions to convert living beings. And therefore, I practice the way of the Pratyeka Buddha. Also, I use the law of compassion to convert living beings. And therefore, I practice the great vehicle. He said, the fragrance of the Buddha's blessing is everywhere. That's the delight, smelling the fragrance of the voice hearers or the Pratyeka of Buddha's blessings. He said there are these Brahmas, Indras, four heavenly kings, heavenly beings, dragon spirits, and others who have entered this room and listened to this great man expound the correct law, all delight in the fragrance of the Buddha blessings and leave their minds set on attaining it. She said, I've been staying in this room for 12 years and never from the first have I heard of any expounding of the law of the voice hearer or the Pratyeka Buddha. I've heard only of the great compassion and pity of the Bodhisattva, the law of the Buddha that is beyond comprehension. So compassion was a new notion that came into Buddhism later, presumably. At least that's how this is being presented, as a new idea to practicers. And I think it's how we journey through our own practice from really, really trying hard to get enlightened and maybe retiring for long periods all by ourselves and doing all the practices of hearing the Dharma and not quite doing it. So this idea of great compassion and pity of the Bodhisattva is introduced into these practices as a way of being not only with oneself and with one practice, but with everybody, everything, really. She said, this room has eight phenomena. It's constantly flooded with rays of golden light that never change. It's never troubled by afflictions. It's constantly the Brahmas and the heavenly kings all are always here. That means here. In this room, there is a constant exposition of the six paramitas and the law. They constantly make superlative music. From their strings come forth the sound of immeasurable Dharma persuasions. The four great storehouses stacked with varied treasures are here. The countless other Buddhas from the 10 directions come at once to this room and broadly expound the teachings, the storehouse of the Dharma. And when they've finished expounding, they go back to where they came from. In this room, magnificently adorned palaces and pure lands of Buddhas are all seen. These are the rare phenomena, Shariputra, sights beyond belief, with still delight in the law of the voice hearer. Shariputra changes the subject and he says, well, why don't you change out of this female body? Which is very rude, really. He thinks he's so smart. How could she be so wise and deep and still be a woman? Why would she want to be like that? So the goddess said, I've been trying to take on female form, but in the end with no success. What is there to change? I haven't found it. Said if a sorcerer were to conjure up a phantom woman and then someone asked her why she didn't change out of her female body, would that be any kind of a reasonable question? No, Shariputra says, phantoms have no fixed form, so that what would there be to change? She said, all things are just the same. They have no fixed form. So why ask why I don't change out of my female form? What were you thinking when you asked? So then she employed her supernatural powers, changed Shariputra into a goddess like herself, while she took on Shariputra's form. And then she said, why don't you change out of this female body? Shariputra, now in the form of a goddess, replied, I don't know why I have suddenly changed and taken on a female body. The goddess said, Shariputra, if you can change out of this female body, then all women can change likewise. Who is not a woman appears in a woman's body. The same is true of all women. Though they appear in women's bodies, they are not women. Therefore, the Buddha teaches that all phenomena are neither male nor female. Then the goddess withdrew her supernatural powers and Shariputra returned to his original form, probably with a huge sigh of relief. And she said, where now is the form and shape of your female body? He said, it was neither made nor changed by me. It doesn't exist. Yet it does not exist. The goddess said, all things are just like that. They do not exist, yet do not exist. And that they do not exist, yet do not exist, is exactly what the Buddha teaches. So this is just about the end. He asks about her rebirth. And she says, there is no birth and death, so don't worry about it. And living beings, too, are without birth and death, so don't worry about it. He says, how long will it be before you attain enlightenment? She says, when you revert to the state of common, unenlightened mortal, then I will succeed in gaining enlightenment. If you can just be ordinary, I'll be enlightened. He says, it's unthinkable that I should become a common mortal again. Ooh, I'm so perfect and so good. She says, it's likewise unthinkable that I should fully attain enlightenment. Because Bodhi is nothing to be thought about, hence nothing to be attained. It's not in any place. It is no location. He said, the Buddhas are now attaining enlightenment. and some have attained it in the past, and in the future they will. What do you say of them? She said, we use numbers, everyday language, and speak of all those as belonging to time. But this is not to say that enlightenment knows anything about time. He said, I've realized there is nothing to be attained, so I've attained it. She said, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are that way too. They've realized there is nothing to attain, and so they've attained it. So there really isn't time for questions, I'm afraid, unless you want to. Slip a couple of patient questions in. I don't know. I'm ready to go home and cool off.
One quick.
Paul?
Insert. The business of inherently compassionate, of being naturally compassionate, is what sets Buddhism and its followers away from the religions that have sin as their basis.
Yes.
And original sin.
Yes.
And so you need the church to be good.
Yes.
Whereas in Buddhism, all you need, not all you need, what you need is to reduce, remove illusion.
Yes.
And you are naturally good.
And you're naturally good if you see it.
Yes.
Yes. And you see the natural goodness in everything.
Exactly.
Yeah, and therefore you're able to help. You can actually do something in the world because you can see it, and you can nourish it in others. Help them to see that they're not all bad. You know, a lot of us were raised in the church that said we're wicked and we'll all go to hell. So it's important to be able to help people see that in spite of our badness, so-called, our lizard brain, I think, you know, we have this whole clutch of leftovers from long, long before survival stuff, and we're not always very nice. But that doesn't mean we have to be like that, and it doesn't mean that we have to accuse others when they're showing their own nasty side. We can help them. And if not help them, at least find ways of creating a safe place for people. It's our biggest challenge as human beings. It's really, really hard to have enough clarity to be able to see what needs to be done. And then very modestly, in the situation, to do something. Even if it's just consoling somebody and helping them to see a little more clearly. Well, thank you all very much. Do our 1 minute sit. Oh, do we have announcements? Announcing Sashin.
I have a little bit of one.
Yes.
I started a second job, so I'm not certain how reliable my schedule is going to be. So I'm wondering if anybody could volunteer to take a seat. Opening every other week. Coming a little bit earlier, putting the chairs out off to the side, setting up these things. Thank you so much. If you want, I can do like a training week with you or something like that to see what I do.
Okay.
Next week. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Nico.